Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Rules to order, and I will also announce for some of you who are here for House Bill 2004, we will not be taking that up today. We will be rolling that over to a future meeting, so stay tuned to OLS on that. We're waiting for another amendment. So we will start. What I'm going to do is I've got a number of bills up for public hearing where there are legislators in attendance who are being called to other duties in these last days of the session. So I'm going to open hearings for legislative testimony and then recess them and kind of toggle back and forth so that people can be accommodated. So I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 644.
Well, sure, you can start with two guys who always agree on everything.
This is really nice to see.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. My name is Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9. Colleagues, Senate Bill 644, I believe, is a really good bill. We're looking at Dash 6. For you that don't know, the senator to my left and I worked very diligently on, I think it was Senate Bill 4?
Three.
Senate Bill 3, and we formed a really good working relationship. 644 has to do with land use, and anytime you touch land use, it gets you get into the weeds pretty darn quick. The problem is that we have counties in eastern Oregon that just flat out aren't doing well. You got negative growth. The land use system really is not working well in these areas. 644 is an attempt to help with the economies of those counties by making it a little, and I underline little, easier to get permits for mining. These counties are sitting on pretty good gold reserves and other precious metals, and what we're trying to do is just to simplify the process and realize that we have to compete with such states as Nevada and Utah to get these mines up there. We're looking as many as 200 or 300 jobs per mine site on a lot of these. So the bill is restrictive in the sense that it has to be at least 500 ounces. It has to create at least 75 jobs. And it does is put the agencies together so that basically you have some coordination.
500,000 ounces.
500,000 ounces. Thank you. 500,000 ounces.
Difference?
We're talking big mines. That was a big correction. Thank you.
Pretty big.
I'm on ways and means. If you lose the decimal point, that's pretty embarrassing. Okay, so anyway, this is a good bill. There was a lot of hard work, and I want to thank Senator Denbrough and also Anna Braun and the agencies. We spent a lot of time coming up with that. You'll hear from a couple people, Rich Angstrom and Dave Honeycutt, will walk you through the bill a little bit more in detail. There's going to be a lot of questions that come up, and they might want to go last so that they could answer those questions. But thanks for hearing this, and I'll turn it over to Senator Denbrough.
Welcome.
Thanks, good colleague. Madam Chair, colleagues, I'm Michael Denbrough. I represent District 23 up in the Oregon Senate. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And just to kind of add to the background that Senator Girod gave, at the beginning of the session, the issues around mining were being looked at in a consolidated manner, that is, both in-stream, you know, the suction dredge mining, and here mining out in eastern Oregon. And we decided to split those two and deal first with the in-stream, which we did. The bill was signed last week. And then, you know, I said, I understand the goals that are being pursued with eastern Oregon. As Senator Girod said, There is a real need for economic vitality out there, and there are resources that, if they can be used appropriately without doing damage to the environment, that is something that we should consider. And so we have been working on this bill for the last couple of months, and I think have made a lot of improvements to it to get it to a point where we hope it won't jeopardize farming interests or, you know, our, obviously our land use system. And just, you know, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do here is to take a process that is believed to be long and cumbersome and try to streamline it so that more is being done at a consolidated statewide level up front. And our hope was to do that in a way that would not hinder local interests, whether they're farming or county government interests. Are we there at this point? I hope so. And you'll hear testimony that, you know, will suggest that we are there. You'll hear testimony that suggests we're not there. If not, I hope that there are just some small changes that need to be made to fix any remaining problems, because I would like to vote for this bill. When we did our work on suction dredge, and actually you have the four of us here who worked on that, at the end of the day,
they finally gave us
at the end of the day, Senator Boquist could not vote for it. Senator Girod did. I'm hoping we'll get this bill to the point where I can do a Girod and not a Boquist, and in a way that we could all feel comfortable with. Thank you, Matt.
Senator Sunshine, right, Senator Barr?
Thank you, and I think we really should get a picture of you for the record. Okay, questions from the committee. Oh, okay, thank you. Are there any other legislators who want to testify on 644? Okay, we will recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 644 and open a public hearing on. Are there legislators here for 432? Okay, we will open a public hearing then on. Where's that bridge thing? 27. On House Bill 2750. Cherie.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2750B modifies requirements related to interstate bridges operated by local governments. The -B7 amendments permit the Port of Hood River to enter into a P3 agreement for a bridge project and sets forth criteria for such an agreement. The amendments permit the port or an entity designated to operate a bridge per an agreement with the port to establish and collect tolls. Additionally, the amendments authorize ODOT to enforce toll collection requirements.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Chuck Thompson, State Senator, District 26 from Hood River, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. I'm here today. This bill started in the House, it passed in the House, but had some reservations by and some concerns by Rep. Hovey that he needed to work on. So the House directed that we have a work group established on the Senate side. So it came through our committee, and I, on business transportation, I got selected to head up the work group. So we had 43 work group meetings in less than 2 weeks. I mean, three meetings? I think we had three work group meetings, not 43. And I think we got to an agreement. Well, I know we've got to agreement. Rep. Hovey worked real hard on this. It was a concern he had because there's only a couple of toll sites in Oregon. One's a Hood River Bridge, the other one's a Cascade Locks Bridge, and I think his main concern was with the idea of the transportation package, or sometime in the future we would be doing possibly some more tolling projects, that the language in this bill would set well for those future projects, and I'm going to let Rep. Hovey explain the rest.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thanks very much for allowing me to testify on House Bill 2750. I think before you have, for the record, State Representative Paul Holvey, District 8 out of South Central Lane County.
Thank you, Senator Byer.
So as this bill came up on the House side, I and a few others identified some issues that we had with the bill. And looking at the statutes and some of the exemptions to the public contracting code, for one, and then how this impacted tolling statutes potentially throughout the state, felt that the bill needed to be narrowed. The port obviously wanted to move forward with a P3 agreement, which our P3 agreements currently in statute talk about ODOT doing P3 agreements and not particularly a port who actually owns this bridge. So long story short, we had at least four, I think, work group meetings and several meetings with on the side of that with Dan Bates representing the port and legislative council trying to craft this bill. So it did allow for the P3 agreement, allowed for the bridge to be sold as well, but put in some protections for the public to make sure we had public access and that there'd be a first right of refusal. Of course, for the port and the state, if it should be sold subsequent to that first P3 agreement. So all in all, supportive of the B7 amendment. I think it addressed all the concerns around the public contracting aspects of the bridge, the P3 agreement, where the exemptions would apply, and also the future public access to the bridge. So happy to have helped get this bill. I think I reported at the last committee that in the Senator Byers' committee that I was a proponent and opponent of the bill at that time. And right now with the B7 agreement, I am a proponent of the bill. So I hope you give it good consideration so we can get this one done.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Senator Roblin.
So, Senator Thompson, did I hear you correctly by explaining that the only tolling in the state is done in your district?
That's right.
I believe so.
Okay, just wanted to make sure that
that's all. They've done that for years.
Yeah. I think there's a train somewhere in Girard's district.
A train in Girard's district, maybe.
It's a ferry.
Used to be
not a train. It's a ferry.
It's a ferry. Ferries
water,
are different.
Not the one that flies.
We did toll the Astoria Bridge for a while, and I remember that. But that's
Madam
gone.
Chair. What? Just comment. So, Senator Thompson, are we led to believe then that you're going to be the champion of tolling?
Well, I pay my share of tolling when we take our food across the river, and we have.
We'll
like
give you other opportunities.
This much distance on both sides, so I lose a few mirrors on our semi truck each summer. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And there is no exemption for Senator Thompson.
No,
in this bill.
You get.
No.
Darn it.
Do you get charged for damaging the bridge?
You usually don't damage the bridge. You just damage your own vehicle. And usually you can't catch the other person going the other way because you can't turn around on the bridge. So they get away.
Madam Chair, I will note that also we did work with also the Department of Transportation in helping us make sure that this makes sense for them going forward as well. And I believe they're supportive or neutral on the bill. Yep. At least.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. I don't see any other legislators signed up for this, so I will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2750 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2308.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. My name is Floyd Przonski, Senator, District 4, parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I'm here to give testimony on House Bill 2308. This is the aid and assist bill where there's an attempt to give credit for individuals who are in custody at the local level then are required to go to the state hospital to determine if they're able to aid and assist. The concept of the bill was to give credit for individuals for whatever they served in the local facility against the 3 years that they can be held in at the state hospital. The bill has gone through multiple changes, and I would submit to you before you today are two amendments for you to consider, the B7 and the B8. I'm here in support of the B7 because I believe this will, in fact, give what is necessary for the hospital to be able to limit the number of people that are coming into the facility for a longer length of time, and also also provide for what many people would think is appropriate to give credit for the time an individual has actually been in custody at the local level against the time that they're in the at the state hospital. The B7 will, in fact, provide for an individual who is charged with a mandatory minimum person crime to be able to receive credit for the time that they're in local custody, with the exception for murder. Also, ag murder is also is exempted out completely from any type of credit. So under the B7s, if a person is charged with murder or ag murder, they will not get any credit for the time that they served at the local level, but instead will have to, the hospital will have up to 3 years of the time that they're actually at the hospital to work with bringing the person back to the ability to be able to aid and assist in their own defense. It should be noted that both murder and ag murder are crimes that are, have no statute of limitations. What that means is that even after 3 years, if they have to release them because they are not able to get them to be fit to go forward for trial, the prosecution can, in fact, bring charges later time if they are able to aid and assist in the future. They are not limited or prohibited through the statute of limitations. The other part that I think is important is that what we're attempting to do is give discretion back to the court, to the judges, to allow them to have more say in these mandatory minimum sentencing cases, and this does, in fact, will provide that. You'll see that under the B7 that the court does have the authority, even with the non-murder, non-ag murder cases, to deny an individual credit for the time they have for the jail. And again, this is to give enhancement on a case-by-case basis to ensure that the judge has the ability, he or she, to make the best determination at as to whether a person should or shouldn't get that credit. I will submit to you, I believe the reason that you have continued opposition from ODAA is because this being a bill that would, in fact, impact mandatory minimum sentencing, that they are trying to protect their perspective as to maintaining the complete control and authority over mandatory minimum sentencing and not allowing a court, the judge, to have any discretion. That's all we have.
Thank you. And then the amendment has been posted, correct, but we don't have yet have paperwork on it.
Right, and that's the B7. And the B8, just to give clarification, this is one that would pull all mandatory minimum sentencing out of the credit. That would be for murder, ag murder, plus all of the other mandatory minimum person crime sentences. That's the differences between the two amendments.
Okay, and the B... the B7 is the more comprehensive one, and the B8 is the most limited one.
That's correct. The B7 actually gives the court more discretion and also will have greater impact as to the population that is at the state hospital as to ensuring that there's enough bed space based on those that can, in fact, be released.
Great. Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
We will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2308 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3454. I'm taking a guess here to buy our second row people. So open a public hearing on House Bill 3454. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Mike McLean. I represent District 55, sitting here with the co-chief sponsor, my good friend, Representative Clem. We brought this bill simply to prevent what has been a concern in other states, but that's lunch shaming. So in Oregon, thankfully, it has not occurred in any widespread manner, but we do have at least one school district that would put stamps on kids' hands to indicate that their parents had not paid the bill. And that would, of course, get noticed by other kids and produce a negative feedback. So in essence, this bill prevents lunch shaming, which says that a school district cannot single out the kid to collect on the parent. And that the collection technique of stamping a hand or pulling a student out of line and or giving the student an alternative lunch of and which would have not been a hot lunch. Other techniques have been ways in which you remind the parents or you know, to pay the bill. So this is something that has brought a lot of attention in other states, and we do have it going in, thankfully, a more mild form here, but it is a factor kids notice, and in an era of with a lot of pressure on kids, we certainly don't need our school districts stamping their hands or whatever. Now, my chief sponsor is the House Advocate for Local Food for Lunches, and I'm glad to have him here. I want to put an end to a rumor, Madam Chair, just right off the top. The fact that he won a contest for being the doppelganger for Chris Farley had nothing to do with the choice of this advocacy. He is here because of his advocacy for school lunches.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem from State District 21, the House District here in Salem, where we reside. And as my co-chief sponsor and friend mentioned, I've been working on the Farm to School program for a long time, and over the years have really become a big believer in how important school lunches are, and particularly when they're being grown by Oregon farmers and provided to kids. And the last thing I want is as a child being unable to get access to a lunch because their parents are having financial issues with the school. So what the bill says is if a child requests a lunch, serve them the lunch and then go work it out with their parents after the fact. But don't label them. Don't put a stamp on their hand. Don't send them a notice. Don't make them go work in the cafeteria for another lunch. Just take it up with their parents. And obviously we'd prefer if it's all Oregon grown food, but we'll see how much money we get out of Ways and Means to see how farm to school fares this session. And with that,
good luck on that.
Yeah, we're trying.
Seriously. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I will put that obviously we're asking you to move the bill. There is a dash A2 amendment that is supported by Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and the Oregon School Boards Association have requested that amendment, and we're supportive of that.
Thank you for bringing that up. We have the amendment. We don't yet have the paperwork. We're reaching the end of the session, so we will probably post this as soon as we get the paperwork.
Thank you, Madam.
Thanks so much.
All right. Senator Boquist.
I just do want to ask that, you know, the end is in sight. It becomes, you know, imperative. Would you rather have the bill or would you rather have the bill and the amendment?
I would rather have the bill, Senator.
Yeah, just checking.
Agreed.
I don't think it will come to that, but thank you for putting that on the record. Okay, we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 3454 and... and open a public hearing on HCR 39, which has the distinction of being the only bill in front of us today that has the paperwork. So, welcome.
Madam Chair, that
including
is wonderful news for me, anyway. Madam Chair, David Brock Smith, State Representative, House District 1, Southwest Oregon. I'll be brief. This is just a concurrent resolution reminding both our partners here in the state and, of course, our economic development partners in China, how much we appreciate the trade that we partake in. There is an amendment because in the bustle of crunching the numbers, the trade is not $3.7 billion, but it's actually $5.8 billion. And so I'm hoping that we can... just fix that number. This, of course, is a we're having the Council China Council General over on July 5th for a ceremony with myself and Senator Roblin and Representative Barker and the governor, and we're hoping to have this all done and signed by them. So I appreciate the chair getting it on her committee.
Good idea.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. We will close the public hearing on HCR 39. I think that's the only testimony. And because of the urgency to get this out before the Chinese delegation gets here, I'm going to open a work session on HCR 39. Shereen, we have an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 39, as you just heard, supports continued coordination between Oregon and China. We have the dash one amendments that make a technical correction regarding export figures. There is no fiscal or revenue impact associated with the underlying bill or the dash one amendments.
Okay, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the dash one amendment to HCR 39, dated 6/5/17.
Senator Farioli has moved the dash one amendment to HCR 39. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 39 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved HCR 39 to the Senate floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion, objections? So ordered.
And
if our China person, Senator Roblin, would be happy to care this, that would be wonderful.
You'll carry it tomorrow.
We'll get this out as quick as we can. It'd be nice to have this done by the time the delegation gets here. Okay, now what we are going to do, we have, I think what we'll do is take one piece of testimony on House Bill 2750. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 20, reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 2750, and we have Dan Bates signed up.
Welcome. Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Dan Bates for the record, representing the Port of Hood River. I don't have much to add to what Senator Thompson, Representative Holdy indicated. I'm happy to answer any questions, but we are indeed supportive of the V7. We believe it does what we need them to do. It was alluded to the fact that we would be entering into a public-private partnership. I do want to actually say that you're opening the possibility for that. There's a lot of different options for replacing this bridge. This bill unlocks that capability for the Port of Hood River so we can actually evaluate the different options. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee. Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2750. And we are going to open a public hearing now on two bills at the same time, Senate Bill 432 and Senate Bill 644. The reason I'm doing this is we have very similar witnesses signed up for both of these bills. So when you come up to testify, you can testify on one, both, or one or both. Mm-hmm. Yes. I was going to say neither, but then what would be the point?
Why would you be here?
Okay. We will start by calling up Roger Kay, Marianne, and Barry Bushwick.
Bushwhack.
We're going to give handwriting lessons now at the beginning of session.
Please put your name.
Well, you tell me what that says. Welcome. Oh, and also, please keep your testimony brief, and there will be an opportunity to submit written comments for the record. The intent with these bills is to send them down to Ways and Means, so feel free to put things on the record if you don't have time. So, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president, Friends of Marion County. I submitted two letters. One on 644 and one on 432 back in March and May. And basically, our opinion of these two bills remains in opposition to each of them. There is nothing that's changed that I can read that would change my opinion of them. So you can read those testimonies. They're in the record. I don't want to just read them and repeat. You're short on time. However, when I'm looking at the website for the Calico Mine and other sources of gold mining, we can see that it takes a huge amount of land to produce 1 ounce, a huge amount of rock, and 1.2 million ounces of gold require like 4,000 acres of land. So that's just a huge amount of consumption of valuable land. And on this estimate on the Calico site, they reported $1,600 per ounce. Right now we're looking at gold at $1,200 to $1,300 per ounce. 8 years ago, 9 years ago, gold was $200 an ounce. So the economics just don't make sense. Gold is a marketable but highly volatile resource, and we should not be destroying 4,000 acres of land for something whose value goes up and down. Thank you.
Who's next?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Barry Bishu, and I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We have concerns with both these bills, so I think I'll just put them both together and talk about our generality. 644, in specific, in our opinion anyway, puts the rights of mining over the rights of agriculture in a largely agricultural district. That's obviously a huge concern to us. We have a number of our members, a number of our county farm bureaus that are adamantly opposed to this, and their testimony is actually on the record. Our concerns are largely around the fact that there appears to be little, if any, opportunity for agriculture to be engaged or to have its voice heard in a process to outright permit mining. I want to make it clear, we're not opposed to mining, but we are opposed to the ability of mines to have the outright authority to just say, you know what, that farm is no longer relevant. We're going to put a mine in the middle of it, and we're going to put the rest of the neighbors at risk. That's a huge concern of ours and a huge concern of our membership. I know that Mary Ann has some more specifics about it that I'll let her talk about in particular, but we do have concerns with this, and we hope that you would vote to oppose this bill and not move it to Ways and Means. As to 432.
Before you move on, Senator Byer, did you have a question?
It's actually regarding, no, I guess it is 644. I'm curious, you mentioned that lots of the county farm bureaus are opposed. I wondered if you know specifically, is the Malheur and Harney Farm Bureau opposed?
Harney certainly is. I don't know if we've heard from Malheur. I'm assuming they are. They're very strong in terms of their protections. And they support our land use policies, which, yeah. Harney specifically, I haven't asked the president of Malheur County other than to just, they're up to aware of what's going on. We've said to them, if you're not comfortable with our position, you need to let us know, and they haven't. So I'm assuming they are.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking that. Oh, welcome.
Do you want me to do 432 or at the same time?
Yes, go ahead.
Certainly we appreciate the work of the folks that have worked on 432 and their vast interest in the rural communities of Oregon, and we respect that. But we feel as if the House or Senate Bill 432 goes far too far in terms of, once again, putting agriculture at risk. It's our understanding that this would pretty well allow most things to happen at the county level in terms of land use planning. Anything that wanted to be done could be done without any of the statewide protections that agriculture currently enjoys. We have letters and letters of support from letters of opposition from all of our county farm bureaus: Harney, Grant, Baker, Gillum, Malheur, Sherman, Wallowa, and Wheeler. They're all counties of concern. Almost all of those counties already have vast resources in terms of available land for industry and certainly housing close into town. We're a little concerned about why this is necessary when those current lands are not being utilized. We believe that largely the reason is not because of land use, but because of other issues that impact, regulatory issues that impact these counties and their lack of ability to draw the kind of industry that they need to create jobs. So those are great concerns of ours. I don't want to dwell on this. I know Mary Ann will probably have some things to add, but once again, we ask you to oppose this bill and not move it to Ways and Means. Our county farm bureaus are very concerned about the option of trophy homes and large houses taking up land, taking it out of production, the kind of problems that we have as agriculture and as farmers with neighbors, not understanding what we do, not caring what we do, moving into a community, trying to make it theirs when, in fact, the farmers have lived there for generations and are trying to make a living. It always concerns me when I hear people say, well, this is
this might bring more money to the county, or this might do this for the county. You know, it's like the old saying, a big farm is only an acre larger than yours. And if we have people that move into a county and expect farmers to quit farming, or at least not listen to the interests that they have in terms of being able to continue, that's a challenge for us. So.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, also here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll be very brief because we do have extensive testimony in the record on both bills, but we'll hit some highlights on each. For Senate Bill 644, I think one of our biggest concerns with it is it's simply not necessary. If you look at land use applications and the success of land use applications for mining in all of the impacted counties, four of them, Baker, Malheur, Harney, and Lake, have 100% success rates with applications for aggregate and surface mining. And in the other three counties, the approval rates are from 92 to 97%. Suggesting that, you know, receiving land use permits is not a problem in these counties. And in our view, those permitting protections are pretty important for the neighbors. They ensure that those mining operations aren't coming in and having a negative spillover impact on the neighbors that would impact their ability to make a living off of farming. So the new process does not contain those protections. It proposes statewide changes to Chapter 517 around mining. And quite frankly, we don't know what the consequences of those are. I think this is always supposed to be somewhat of a county-specific bill, but the 517 changes have become wholesale across all mining applications. And we're just unsure of why that is. And the portions of that are specific to looking at impacts to neighbors, it doesn't allow ODA to make the determinations. We were not opposed to some sort of consolidated permitting process if it kept some of the existing standards in place, but allowed them to be consolidated up into one process. But this does not do that. It definitely allows DOGAMI to decide what is appropriate for conditions and whether or not the concerns of agriculture will be listened to and the concerns of neighbors will be listened to. So we feel very strongly that ODA should be the one to decide whether or not there are impacts in cases where there are concerns raised. And we also disagree that compensation alone is an appropriate response to any concerns raised. I don't know many farmers that would continue farming if their operation was jeopardized and they were just being, you know, paid out, whether it was annually or over the life of the mine. We think mitigation is always the solution, and that is what has worked, you know, with a 92 to 100% success rate in these exact same counties. I also want to mention that this bill contains right-to-mine protections within the impacted counties that are much, much broader than right-to-farm and appear to even expand beyond nuisance and trespass into negligence and finding that mining is not an ultra-hazardous activity if it is done in compliance with permits. While I will say that there's robust permits required, and we certainly sympathize with the burden that that imposes, those permits do not cover every conceivable source of particularly negligence or strict liability. And so it's essentially barring an action when there may or may not be a permit in place that would actually cover that harm. It also applies much broader than just the significant resource sites that the earlier provisions of the bill apply to. Section 14 plainly applies to all surface mining in those counties. We don't know if that includes aggregate mining as well, but it's certainly broader than just the big gold mines and the big mineral mines. So in closing on 644, we do want to say we support mining. It just can't be at the expense of agriculture, and it can't be at the expense of silencing the neighboring landowners and eliminating their remedies. And we are concerned that this does exactly that. They lose the ability to raise and have their concerns addressed on the front end. And then if there is some sort of spillover effect, damage to their commercial agricultural products, they aren't able to raise those in the back end. And that is very different than right to farm and much, much broader. And so we have big concerns about that. So for 644,
if you could be more brief. On
yes, 432, I will be more brief. The fundamental part with 432 is it essentially allows an exception for any business or housing activity with, again, no regard or no ability for neighbors to really raise concerns about impacts. It could allow a landowner's land to be rezoned and potentially have them lose their farm use assessment, which would skyrocket their tax rates without them having the ability to comment on that. And hopefully, again, the county would allow them to prove up and stay in farm use assessment, but I believe that is done differently on a county-by-county basis. One of the biggest concerns that we had heard from our impacted counties, and you do have letters on the record for them, is that this will just cause land prices to skyrocket and make it so that, you know, you'll have maybe one more generation of farming or ranching, but then, you know, it will become lucrative for all their neighbors to sell out. And then you start to lose, you know, your fertilizer store, your feed store, and people coming into the county and wanting to invest in agriculture in the county. So it makes it much more difficult for the remaining farmers and ranchers that want to stay on the land. And so I think their biggest concern is everybody around them will, you know, parcelize out and sell the trophy homes or other kinds of residential homes. And, you know, those will no longer be agricultural counties. And in some of them, they're particularly concerned about vacation or amenity owners, where you may have a booming population 3 months out of the year. But then the rest of the year, you know, you have a ghost town. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to testify. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So relative to the mining, 644, have any of you visited the Calico mine site?
No, I have.
No, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Farioli, no, I have not.
Okay.
Are you asking everyone? Or
yes.
There is a webpage that I reviewed which talks about what the proposal seems to generate in terms of wealth for the county. But if you take a look at another website, and I look on the website, it says, how much gold is in a ton of rock? It could be anywhere from 2 to 91 tons that yield 1 ounce of gold. And that's where I got my information from. I did not go visit the site. Okay. There isn't a site yet. It's still an application.
Thank you. Madam Chair, follow-up. The size of Harney County, anybody know it offhand, off the top?
My guess is going to be way off.
Huge.
Huge, yeah.
Huge. Okay. Anybody? No guesses? So it's 4,000 acres for the mine site. It's 10,000 square miles, and only 10% of that is in private ownership. So when we're talking about impact, if you've been to the property, I would, if you have, put it this way, I would love to have a group of folks go to that property and see if you can find some agricultural uses there. And Madam Chair, I'd like to talk about 344 for just a second. Relative to your testimony on 344, have you read the 342. Open on bill. Have you read the Dash 13 amendments?
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Farioli, yes, I have.
Okay, and the Dash 13 amendments are specifically designed to protect high-value farmland.
Would you like a response or just a...
I'm just making a statement for the record. Madam Chair, the only other thing I'd like to talk to you about 432 for the record. I've distributed a letter from the seven counties at least have signed a record that says they are strongly in favor of Senate Bill 32 with the Dash 13 amendments. So we have the elected county officials who are asserting that destruction of agricultural land and uncontrolled development without appropriate protection for high-value farmland is not something that they will likely to be to look at approvingly, since they are from the farming and ranching community mostly. They do point out that their communities are losing population. They are not currently sustainable. And even the agricultural activities that are there are turning more and more to mechanization. So we're losing population, and they are in the process of consolidation. So we're seeing fewer and fewer family ranches that are passing from one family member to another. They're becoming corporate. They're becoming very large. And the concern in those Eastern Oregon communities is that keeping their schools open, keeping their Main Street businesses vibrant and thriving is a serious problem for them. They are not seeing the uncontrolled real estate boom that you're seeing in places like Bend or Portland. As a matter of fact, the opposite is true. None of these counties are included in Senate Bill 432 unless they have lost population since the last decadal census. So it's a little bit different picture than the idea that hordes of California developers are waiting at the border to sweep over the landscape and and destroy the agricultural community. I think that is not an accurate portrayal of what's really intended by 432. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I probably should have asked you to go testify.
I just did. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now we'll have Dave Honeycutt, Aaron Doyle, and Mike Eliason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, excuse me, here in support of both 432 and 644. I'm going to direct my remarks to 432. Mr. Angstrom will pick up 644. On 432, as Senator Farrelly said, this bill applies to eight counties: Harney County, Malheur County, Baker County, Grant County, Wallowa, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler. I think the letter that Senator Farrelly referenced has emblems from seven counties. The one that's missing, I believe, is Gillum County. And I know Steve Schaefer, who's the county judge in Gillum County, they're supportive of this as well. So it would actually be all eight counties, not just seven of the eight counties. Senate Bill 432 deals with, it's a land use bill, but it deals with eight counties that have lost population between the 2000 and 2010 census. And in fact, six of those eight counties are smaller today in population than they were in 1950. These are frontier counties, 35,000 square miles of land area with a population of about 72,000. So when you contrast that with Medford, the city of Medford has 75,000 people on 25 square miles. So we're talking real frontier counties, and these frontier counties are dying. To give you an idea of how the bill would work, and I'll be brief, Madam Chair, I appreciate the, I know where you're trying to go on this, so I will be brief. The bill would apply for these counties that have lost population until the county grew by 1,000 people over a 10-year period of time. So if a county grows from census to census by more than 1,000 people, then the exceptions process, the new exceptions process that's outlined in the bill, would no longer apply. To give you an idea of what 1,000 people is like, the Portland metro area has grown very steadily over the last 20 years. In the Portland metro area, we add 1,000 people every 12 days. So this is 1,000 people over 10 years, and if by some chance any of those counties would grow by 1,000 people in 10 years, then the exceptions process that's granted to give these counties the ability to grow would be taken away, and they'd just go back to the existing system. So it's a very small, for all the angst over this bill, it's the impact on the ground is very small. And so we're very supportive of this bill. The primary issue for these counties is not where the growth goes, it's that they're not growing at all. And frankly, as I told you when we met, Madam Chair, if Sherman County gets 1,000 people, new people, we ought to have a party down here rather than condemning them. So love this bill. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, and thanks to Senator Farrelly for bringing this bill. It's a great bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties, speaking on behalf of the impacted counties in both Senate Bill 432 and Senate Bill 644. With respect to Senate Bill 432, I believe Vice Chair Senator Farrelly and Mr. Honeycutt have amply outlined our support and reasons for our support. I would just submit that these counties are very much struggling, and any measure of local self-determination that can be given to them can only be a good thing from their perspective. These are folks, again, as was referenced, that have grown up and are in and around the farming community and industry and have no
incentive or interest in harming that that industry at all. Simply would like to be able to attract additional industry and diversify their counties and give themselves a chance to grow. Also, as referenced, high-value farmland has been taken out of the bill. The exceptions process does not apply to high-value farmland in the latest amendments, as well as addressing the sage-grouse plan language as well. So with respect to Senate Bill 432, our counties are very much in support. Also in support of Senate Bill 644, for similar but also some different reasons, there's high potential mineral deposits that have been identified, and we would love to see some of those eastern Oregon counties have an opportunity to cite what could be a potentially really impactful industry in their communities. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities regarding only Senate Bill 432. I don't do mining in cities. It's not recommended. We have supported the concept around Senate Bill 432 since at least 2013. And the reason why is because a lot of our cities out there, they don't want to do giant, massive changes to their land use plans. But when they want to do something simple like rezone some property from industrial commercial use into residential because the five available lots can't be built because the owners don't want to build them, they enjoy their large acreage of their neighboring property and theirs, they look at a price tag that's $10,000. Just to do all the studies that are necessary to support that sort of land use change. And let's just say that is a quarter of the annual budget. And that's a lot to get a couple of houses built where they have people who actually would like to move into town. There isn't a concern about sprawl out in Eastern Oregon, as far as I've seen, as I've driven through going to the meetings I'm lucky enough to go to with our local officials. But there is also, at the local level, a recognition of the economic drivers and the things that are important to the community. These folks are out there in the grocery stores talking to their neighbors. They have contentious city hall meetings if something is really problematic. I think the counties are similarly active and engaged with their local leadership is active and engaged and doesn't want to see the destruction of their communities. What they want to see is the opportunity to take advantage of opportunities. I would also point to on OLIS, in 2015, Senate Bill 25, which was a previous iteration of this bill, there's a letter under my name that was done by a contracting planner out in Eastern Oregon. And they wanted to bring the airport into the city of Condon. And the amount of effort it was going to take made it impossible for the city of Condon to move forward with either one out of the four studies that the regional representative said was going to be necessary in order to do that. That area was already planned for economic development. They wanted to continue economic development, but they couldn't afford to expand their UGB to add that airport. And I think that's kind of indicative of why Senate Bill 432 and the amendments are necessary. And the last thing I'll say is population drives our land use system for the most part, particularly relating to housing. And if you're not seeing population growth, it's almost impossible to justify land use changes. And I think what we're trying to do in Senate Bill 432 is reverse that. Instead of saying in order to grow more, you have to have grown more, you're saying in order to try to grow more, we're going to give you the flexibility you need to encourage people to bring their businesses or housing here. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, just one more comment. Sage-grouse is protected in the bill. High-value farmland, it's not in the bill. And if you look at the long view, the maximum impact this bill could have, Senate Bill 432, would be 8,000 persons scattered over 40,000 square miles. Is that your understanding?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, yes, it's 8,000 people over, I think it's 35,000 square miles, but we're in the ballpark. Actually, to be completely accurate, it's 8,200 people, because what the bill says is 1,000 people or 4% of the county's population, whichever is larger. Malheur County has about 30,000 people, so they would lose the ability to use the bill at 1,200 people as opposed to 1,000 people. So 8,200 people, 35,000 square miles.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Every decade. Question to the left.
Senator Robey.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that I got that clarification. So if Boise decided to move up and move over to Ontario, they couldn't all, they stop them at the border when they got to the first 1,000 or they have to wait 10 years.
1,200.
That's it.
Madam Chair, Senator Roblin, the determination is made on a census-by-census
So the whole city, they could all move in the first chance they got.
Madam,
I want to give Boise the opportunity.
Madam Chair, Senator Roblin, yes.
They can't bring their stadium, however. I don't like blue turf. But other than that, but I no, they could be more. It's just that they have to wait for the next census. But, again, I don't see that happening.
Madam Chair, I want a clarification. I think the if a county accomplishes the population growth specified in the bill sooner than a decade, it cannot it loses the ability to continue once it hits the population growth.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I don't believe that's accurate because the growth is measured by on a census by census.
Okay, so we'd be looking at maximum 10.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure that we're going to get there. I'm just saying I don't see that happening. I just, the way I read it the way you did. And I just want to make sure that I was being clarified because I don't see them moving over, but I do see the opportunity if things start to happen of a greater growth. I have not seen that happen in other places that have these, Washington State, for example, and others. I've not really seen this kind of growth, but I
think if you saw the city of Boise migrating over, I think probably the legislature would devote its attention
really?
That point.
No, I was thinking about the National Guard myself.
All right. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay. Now we'll take Rich Engstrom.
Good afternoon. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm representing the Oregon Mining Association today for testimony. We've worked pretty hard on this all through session on this bill, engaged all stakeholders from the agricultural community, the cattlemen, which, by the way, are supportive of the bill, the state agencies, various legislators, and we worked really hard with Denbro in trying to accommodate all the issues within Senate Bill 644. Specifically on the sage-grouse, we spent a lot of time to make sure the sage-grouse are protected. We actually had to get a legislative council opinion because there's some dispute on that to make sure that we did protect the sage-grouse. The bill really does a couple of things. This is not an 8-county bill. This is a 7-county Eastern Oregon bill. And I would like to again say each county that we work with is in full support. What we do is we define significant mineral mines, and these will apply to not only the chemical mines but also the non-aggregate mines. And we set a threshold for those big mines at 500,000 ounces and 75 jobs, and for the non-aggregate mines, 100 jobs. And if you think about the importance of those mines over east, you only have to look at like Ash Grove Cement, which is 126 jobs, or EP Minerals, and I'm not sure what the jobs are for EP Minerals that are in Vail, but those are significant economic drivers for those communities. We keep local government in control of health and safety and transportation, sage grouse and bird strikes around airports. We address farm conflicts in a unique way that we think is important policy shift that I think causes most of the angst. And that is, instead of having the local governments deal with the agricultural conflicts with the mining community, we shift those over to the state agencies. And Dogan, because it's the chief permitter and ODA does not issue permits, they have to work with ODA to identify the conflicts and work to avoid them or minimize them. And one of the things that we introduced, which is a new concept that actually was, I believe, Senator Dembro's idea, is to allow the, based on an arm's length transaction with the adjacent farmer, so say there's a mine and usually mine might be on a farmer or rancher's land, but an adjacent farmer or rancher might be impacted. The new concept is allow those two to get together and figure out how to compensate
the impacted farmer. So there's a compensatory mitigation aspect to it, which we thought was kind of a unique approach. Get them talking and see if they can solve their own problems. The bill does have some streamlining provisions. We do deal with nuisance and trespass, and what I want to say on that, just real briefly, is what this bill does is if a mine operator is within his permit conditions, and there's a lot of them for multiple state agencies, he's protected from nuisance and trespass. And we thought that was a fair exchange for all the regulation and things that if they're operating, they're protected at least from those two types of suits. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to just stop right there. We support this bill. We've worked hard on it. We've tried to accommodate everything that's come at us on it. We know there's some policy shifts on it that this committee has to deal with, but we think those are good policy shifts. For instance, the agricultural one, we think that'll lower the temperature on all mining with the agricultural community, get it back into the state process, make it a more technical decision versus more of a political decision on the local level. So we'd encourage this committee to move this bill over to Ways and Means, and hopefully we can get it passed this session. So with that, I conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Roblin.
Yeah. Were there any real big discussions on the impacts with regard to road construction, transportation, that kind of stuff out here where these mines might be getting to and from where they need to be?
Chair Burdick and Senator Roblin, not that I know of out there. If I only take the Calico site, which is the only one that's actually kind of being permitted at the moment, its mine area is about 56 acres, and its permitted boundary is, I think, 285 acres. And so it's not a great big footprint, and the roads going out to it, we intend to do a tour. You guys should come. It's pretty darn remote, and I don't remember seeing more than a couple of cows. It's kind of a couple of cows per 100-acre kind of area. But there would be some workers going out because this would be an over 100-employee site. Representative Bentz gave a great presentation to the House committee last year showing the reclamation, and basically it's going to be restored back to you won't even know it was ever there. So it's pretty unique. But on the transportation issues, we keep the counties in control of that. So if there's conflicts around ingress, egress, or other road-related problems, then the local governments get to address that. But in my read on that and looking at it and having toured it myself, it's hard for me to believe there's going to be much of a ruckus over transportation-related issues.
Thank you. Follow-up, please.
So the only concern I have is that these counties do not have a lot of resources. Are they going to be responsible for upkeep of roads and all that kind of stuff because they will be county roads?
Yes, that's a good question. Chair Burdick and Senator Roblin, if you remember the EP Mineral site, that was a county road that literally was being rubbled by all the traffic, not just from the mine, but all the traffic. And the local government, I think ODOT finally came in and under some larger agreement and fixed that road for EP Minerals. I think the counties were significantly involved in it also, but I don't know how the money played out. The EP Mineral site, which is a diatomaceous earth site, moves a large volume of material. The numbers, I believe, on the Calico site, as an example, are going to be like 1.4 million ounces of gold and 4 million ounces, around 4 million ounces of silver. It won't have the large trucking traffic, except for maybe some of the development of the processing facilities around it that might be more temporary in nature. So because it's not moving, you know, aggregate amounts of material, I don't think they're going to have the same, heavy haul vehicles going over the road at the frequency and intensity that, say, an EP Minerals or even an aggregate site might have.
Mary Kyle McCurdy, Thomas Masher, and Peggy Lynch.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm going to speak to both bills, which we oppose, but I'm going to preface both by saying I spent the weekend in Wallowa County with ranchers who are struggling to make a living on very good ranch land. It's not high-value ranch land because there is no high-value ranch land. Ranch land is not part of the definition of high-value lands. and they oppose this bill, both bills. I'm going to speak first to Senate Bill 432. Senate Bill 432 threatens the number one industry in eastern Oregon, agriculture, and it's the number two industry in the state. With uncertainties, conflicts, and speculative sprawling development, it doesn't have to be that way. We shouldn't be threatening the number one industry in eastern Oregon what is a value I think we all share, the desire for more economic development and diversity in eastern Oregon. But this bill is rather one-sided. It applies to counties under 50,000 that had no population growth between the 2000 and 2010 census, allowing a city or county to take an exception to any land use planning goal anywhere for almost any reason.
Okay, Kyle, can you step back from the mic a little bit? Thanks.
Exceptions could be taken that cover any or all of a city or county, negating urban growth boundaries, exclusive farm use zoning, requirements for affordable housing, natural resource protections, et cetera. There are eight counties under 50,000 that are impacted by this bill that did not have growth between 2000 and 2010. However, six of those counties have grown since 2010, two of them substantially. Only two of them have not grown during that time period, yet all eight would be impacted by this. I have read the Dash 13 amendments, and I will speak to the definition of high value in that amendment. It is a narrower definition than we currently have in state law, and it doesn't include irrigated lands, and it does not include ranch land. In five of those eight counties, there is 0 to 1% high value farmland. There's 6% in Baker County, 25% in Malheur County, and 30% in Sherman County. And the other five, there's 0 to 1%. As I mentioned, the number one agricultural product in Oregon is cattle and calves, which are largely produced in eastern Oregon. Of the top 20 of Oregon's top 20 agricultural products, many are grown primarily in eastern Oregon, including hay, wheat, potatoes, onions, and mint. Southeastern Oregon has almost 3,000 farms producing a value of over $1,715 million and generating many times that amount in related local jobs and businesses. I assume that's why the two farm bureaus in that area, as you've heard, oppose this bill. Northeastern Oregon has over 2,500 farms, including 230,000 acres of irrigated land. This farm and ranch land produces a market value of almost $300 million. Senate Bill 432, the risks of it include land fragmentation, making it difficult and more expensive to ranch and farm, increasing conflicts with non-farmers and their objections to farm practices, uncertainty as to what conflicting uses might locate nearby, and a loss of the critical mass of farmers and ranchers to support the nearby agricultural-related businesses, such as equipment dealers, agricultural product processors, mechanics, and more. It puts at risk stability and certainty and puts in its place a patchwork of compliance with the state's land use planning goals, thereby jeopardizing farm tax assessment, right to farm protection from complaints for common farm practices, farm use as an outright permitted use and all the protections that go with it, and the regulation of farm and non-farm uses on farmland and nearby. Predictability will be gone. And that also will impact facilities that cross county lines that today can rely upon a baseline of land use compliance even when they're operated in many counties. If left to each locality, this could mean variability jurisdiction to jurisdiction and thus discouraging such development. It doesn't have to be this way. We can have more effective solutions for growing and diversifying the Eastern Oregon economy, including investment in value-added production, research and development of new products, growing local businesses related to the region's assets, and investing in diverse types of infrastructure, including roads, high-speed internet service, and improved air access. The ranchers I was with this weekend would in particular like a processing facility for their beef so they don't have to ship it out of state. Thank you. Turning quickly to 644, you've heard more detailed information from the Farm Bureau on 644. I'd like to just mention a few things. The definition of mining is quite narrow, as well as areas that are impacted. For example, what does other on-site construction or non-surface impacts of underground mines mean? So those are accepted from the bill. And we are concerned that the exception provided to compliance with sage-grouse rules means that a critical part of the sage-grouse rules would be avoided, thereby putting at risk the sage-grouse conservation plan and making it more likely that it might be listed by the federal government. And I think I'll just end there because you've heard quite a bit on that bill already. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Mosier, for the record, and I'm here representing Central Oregon Land Watch. On both bills, we oppose. You've heard a lot already, and we mirror pretty much everything that's been said so far. On 644, quickly, I'll just say that we believe that it creates an unnecessary exemption to land use policies that were put in place, important land use policies, and to create a path for an end run around our land use system not only sets a dangerous precedent, but also goes against our very core values as Oregonians, which we understand the value of mining, but we think that to just sort of allow it whole cloth like this in some ways is not the right move. On 432, we appreciate the work, but we also think it goes too far. There's been shown no correlation between land use rules and population growth, that relaxing land use rules would somehow grow population, and for that reason we think this is just another unnecessary end run around land use rules that are wildly important. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. First of all, I'd like to talk about Senate Bill 432, which we oppose. And I dropped by your offices a copy of the latest employment, workforce and employment economic information from for May. I want to make a quick note of that information, and I have handed a copy to your assistant to put on the record. This was the lowest unemployment rate for Grant County since comparable records began in 1990. So we are seeing changes happening in eastern Oregon. Gilliam County saw its unemployment rate improve over the year by 2.9 percentage points, more than any other county. Yes, the numbers are small when you're talking about that few people. A percentage is really small, but it is important to say that there are things happening in these counties. Grant and Harney County are the only two that have lost population since 2010 through 2016. And what's important about the 2000 to 2010 numbers, frankly, is that was during the Great Recession. We now see that Baker County has grown 2%, Gilliam by 5.8%, Malheur 1.3%, Sherman 1.7%, Wallowa 1.9%, and Wheeler 1.7%. So we are seeing some growth in those counties. The League is not interested in not having healthy eastern Oregon counties where some of our members live. The Grant County Commissioner testified in a Ways and Means Committee in support of forest cooperatives. We believe that in the ODF budget that's coming, going to be heard tomorrow, will include money for the forest cooperatives, and that's critical for their infrastructure and for their jobs. The Sherman County Commissioner came here and testified on behalf of five-acre ranchettes. That's the kind of thing we're saying we don't believe is helpful for eastern Oregon. I've shared with you. Mary Kyle mentioned irrigated lands, the fact that Class 1 and Class 2 soils are the only ones listed as high-value farmland in eastern Oregon are not representative of the kind of farmland in eastern Oregon that is important to eastern Oregon agriculture. And irrigated lands for which we often help pay to make happen. The exception to all the goals, I would like to remind you that I believe that all 19 goals are a reflection of Oregonians' values. And after the first 10 were selected and then they went out, the LCDC and CIAC went out to the statewide to talk about what should be in our land use goals. Goals 11 through 14 were added because citizens recognized the needs for infrastructure, the need to make livable communities. And this would exempt not only goal 1, citizen involvement, but all of those other goals through some exception process. And LCDC's role seems to be only to make sure that the applications are complete. That doesn't seem to have any role other than that in the bills. I will say that Section 9 of the latest amendments have a business and housing fund. If we have the dollars, and we have been fighting all session for more revenue, if we had the dollars, perhaps it would be important to have a fund for these Eastern Oregon counties, even though they are growing and their employment is better. So those are 432 and part of the reasons we object. Senate Bill 644.
You can be more brief on 644. I appreciate
try to be brief on 644. So Senator Farioli knows, I have been following the Calico mine process and the consolidated mining process. In fact, because this is the first time we have used this streamlined process where all of the agencies have been together, I call in and listen to the conversations. One of the conversations has not been around the Department of Agriculture's role and the discussion that you have heard here earlier. And I follow the Natural Resource Agency budgets. Dogami, as far as I know, has no expertise in this area. And there is no requirement in the amendments that say that they need to consolidate or consider and listen to the Department of Agriculture in their issues. There is a provisional permit on page 10, line 7, et cetera, of the amendment in 644. And it says that you can go ahead and begin to mine with your provisional permit before all of the others are done. And I have to tell you that this is a good process, the consolidated agency process, because it has ODF&W and water resources and everybody together at the table. But a provisional permit saying that you can go ahead and do it before these agencies have had a chance to consider seems to be interesting. We are concerned about the right to mine. We do support Section 9, which is the section that says that Dogami should put all the information on their website. Thank you very much. Senator Roblin mentioned a comment about roads and the concern about county roads. I believe the state has already provided some money for roads going into the Calico mine process, and so it is a statewide issue and a statewide fiscal issue. It's not just a county issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, next we'll hear from Carrie McLaren and Greg McPherson.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg McPherson. I'm chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and I'm accompanied by Deputy Director Carrie McLaren of the department that works with our commission. I'm going to defer to her to comment first on Senate Bill 644, and then I'll offer some comments on Senate Bill 432.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, and our chair, Greg McPherson. All I wanted to do actually on 644 in the interest of time was note that we had submitted a joint agency letter that has been posted on OLIS. I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have about that if you would like, but otherwise don't have any additional comments to add.
And your position is neutral?
Sorry, Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Okay, and your position is neutral on that?
Oh, yes, sorry, we have no position. I thought you were asking for my position description. My apologies. No, we have no position on the bill.
No, and I'm glad. I forgot to ask your name. Usually I'm more diligent than that.
The commission also has no position on these bills in deference to our relationship with the governor's office, but I'm appearing and offering my personal observations here, which are not formal positions of either the commission or the department. Much of what I was going to comment has already been said, and I won't drag you through that, but I do want to emphasize some things. One is that, as has been pointed out, actually, there's been growth in eastern Oregon. Most of these counties have grown since the last decennial census. And the proponents of this bill seem to have cherry-picked the data. That is, they took the decade from 2000 to 2010, which started with a boom time at 2000, and then took the depths of the Great Recession in 2010 in order to identify eight counties that had no population growth in that time. All but two of those counties have reversed ground. They are growing now. So, and in fact, those are the only two that have declined since the last decennial census are Grant County and Harney County. And my understanding is that Harney County has declined to sign on to, as a proponent of this bill. So I think we ought to declare victory and go home here, because in fact, the trend lines that have existed within the last decade have now not been the case here for the last 6 years. I want to offer up a couple more comments about the bill in some of the details that have not been commented on. One is that it has an odd rule that limits the standing to object to exceptions that are being taken by local governments to those people. You can object only if an exception impinges on the person's use or enjoyment of land owned by the person. So you've got to be a landowner in order to be able to object to an exception that's taken to our land use laws under this bill. We used to have a system in this country, you know, ages ago, where you had to be a white male property owner in order to vote. Well, we got rid of that a long time ago, and now we're moving the wrong direction. You're saying you have to be a property owner to object to an exception. And that would carve out a lot of farmers who farm rented land, for example. So there's some real flaws in the way this bill works. There's also another really odd provision, which is cutting off any appellate review, any appeal court, if you're turned down on an objection to an exception that's been taken by a local government. And so you can imagine just an example that could happen. There's a property owner, so they do have standing, is worried about new development that is being proposed under an exception that would deplete their well water, because we have some very constrained groundwater situations through much of eastern Oregon. That person then challenges to the local court, and they lose. That's it. They cannot appeal to the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court. I'm not aware, as having spent 40 years practicing law, of any other area of the law that cuts off totally any appellate review by statute. People do this when they submit to arbitration, but I'm not aware of this being a provision in our statute. So there's some odd things in this bill and it's not necessary, because the problem has basically reversed itself that it was designed to address. So those are some observations about it. We have an important partnership going between our commission and department and the local governments, and it has proven quite successful in addressing some important issues, like, for example, the potential listing of the sage grouse in eastern Oregon, which would have been a major problem for that part of the state. And as a result of the rulemaking process we went through several years ago, the sage grouse was not listed as an endangered species, and that's in fact the proponents of the bill have conceded this point, because they carved this out in the amendments so that sage grouse rules can continue to apply. But all the other provisions of our statewide planning goals would be in effect basically put on an opt-out basis, which would allow the local governments in those counties to decide. We just don't want to abide by those. So anyway, thank you for your attention. Members of the committee, I could take any questions.
Thank you. Senator Farrell.
Well, Madam Chair, despite the admonition that we'd be listening to testimony from an individual, we're talking about the partnership between the agency and the local governments. I just wanted to point out that Harney County, Gillum County, Malheur County, Wallowa County, Grant County, Sherman County, Baker County, have all signed on to support the -13 amendments with a due pass recommendation on 432. So it would seem to me that all of those partners really would appreciate the bill being passed. So I'd urge you to reassess your assessment of your partnership with those eight counties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, next we will have Paige Spence.
Madam Chair, if I may, just one moment. I had wanted to comment very briefly on 432, which is, again, just a reference for the record, that there's a joint letter dated May 12th from state agencies, from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Department of Forestry, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Energy. The concerns we have reviewed, they wrote this letter obviously before the Dash 13 amendments came out. In the interest of time, we reviewed the Dash 13 amendments to see if we needed to change our testimony. The concerns represented in this bill, in our letter of May 12th, have not been addressed by the Dash 13 amendments. Again, we offer that and are here to answer any technical questions this committee may have. We do not have a position on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next we'll have Paige Spence, Catherine McDonald, and Catherine Jernstead.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Ferrioli, and Vice Chair Ferrioli, and committee members. Thank you for hearing Senate Bills 432 and 644. For the record, Paige Spence, Director of the Oregon Conservation Network, OCN for short, which is coordinated through the League of Conservation Voters, and is a coalition of nearly 40 not-for-profit organizations throughout the state. OCN operates by identifying bills that we support or that we have concern with, and advocating accordingly. And each session, we also bring forth our priorities, and during session identify a few bills that are so undermining to our mission that we identify them as major threats. And unfortunately, we try to use this designation sparingly, but Senate Bills 432 and 644 both have risen to that list. In the previous panel of testimony, you heard from 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and the Central Oregon Land Watch. All three of these groups are OCN members, so please accept their testimony as mine as well and indicative of OCN's position. The organization within OCN who is not able to be here today in person is the Oregon Natural Desert Association, so I'd like to speak for a moment to their concerns. As an initial matter, the Oregon Natural Desert Association is concerned that both Senate Bills 432 and 644, as we've heard inklings of, could lead to impacts to the important sage-grouse work that is ongoing with the Oregon Action Plan for Sage-Grouse and the administrative rules that are implementing that plan with DLCD and Oregon Fish and Wildlife. With respect to 432, new developments on agricultural land in eastern Oregon could have significant and lasting impacts on important sage-grouse habitat, exactly the sort of impacts that are why the state developed a comprehensive sage-grouse plan in the first place. We strongly feel that that plan needs to be allowed to work in conjunction with the federal plans to best support sage-grouse recovery. Regarding Senate Bill 644, the provisions of this bill as amended still risk undermining Oregon's significant and long-term investment in the sage-grouse conservation. Despite the language of the proposed amendments, a county could still make a determination that a large-scale mining operation does not conflict with the administrative rules for sage-grouse conservation and essentially moot the sage-grouse plan requirements. The risk to years of conservation efforts are not warranted when a major mining project, such as one envisioned by Senate Bill 644, already has feasible pathways for reasonable and thoughtful permitting through county land use plans and the Oregon administrative rules. An additional point of opposition to Senate Bill 644 is that mining facilities are often expansive in scale and may remain on the landscape for decades or longer. Large-scale and long-duration mining operations can result in significant impacts to the environment, including water quality, water quantity, and air quality, and each has very real implications for farm uses. So the Oregon Conservation Network, in closing, urges you to oppose both of these bills and instead identify other mechanisms to support rural economic development without impacting our state's natural resources and agricultural lands. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who would like to be next?
Vice Chair Ferrioli, my name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Director of External Affairs for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon, members of the committee. We wanted to just voice our opposition to both 432 and 644. We appreciate that there have been efforts to try and improve the language to address sage-grouse. The Nature Conservancy was very involved in helping the state develop the sage-grouse action plan, but we have some continuing concerns about the impacts that these two bills could have on that effort. And we also have a much bigger concern about the broader impacts it could have, these two bills could have on fish and wildlife habitat in general. It's great to try and fix a solution, find a solution for one species, but there are a lot of other important roles that the land use system plays in helping us protect important fish and wildlife habitat. And then more broadly, we strongly support the state's land use laws and think that it's provided a great foundation for the state of Oregon. We appreciate the challenges to the economic, the rural economy in eastern Oregon, and also urge other ways of trying to address that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am?
My name's Catherine Jernsted. I'm here as a member of Friends of Yamhill County and also as a resident of the family Century Farm in Yamhill County. And I appreciate being able to talk in both roles about both bills because they're rather interconnected. The Friends of Yamhill County is committed to protecting our natural resources through land use planning goals, policies, and laws. And yes, we are Yamhill County, but the public ownership in Harney County is our entree, to be sure, into some of this stuff. But basically, we're concerned that with 644, the mining bill, the mechanism exists to approve mining activity in its current form, as has actually occurred, and that the deliberation and careful review is appropriate, especially when you consider that ag is the number one industry in that part of the state and in number two in the state overall. There needs to be time and careful and impartial review of information, and it's often technical and specialized in nature. Absent any meaningful infrastructure investment, the long-term success of any of these island activities is not good. Eastern Oregon needs an airport, not another drain on their water resources, and not their own opportunity to create a legacy of brownfield sites. To 432, again, I speak as a member of a long-term farming family, and in the Jernsted clan, there's two government programs that are credited with our legacy. We gained our Century Farm status in 1991 and claim it continue now 25 years later. The first biggie was rural electrification. It allowed our farm to enter the 20th century, light so the kids could study, college graduates out of the lot, and efficiency to the farm. Senate Bill 100 is the second one. It provided for the survival and continuity of the lands held by the family and still actively farmed into the 21st century. Fragmentation of land use planning is not going to be helpful to agriculture as a whole, or particularly, I believe, these sections of Eastern Oregon, as you've heard from the economic testimony. What would help Eastern Oregon and all rural communities, including my part of Yamhill County, would be investment in high-speed internet infrastructure. But mainly, or the last point I want to make, I haven't heard mentioned yet, is this, yes, they're public officials, yes, they're locals, and they are very much invested in their community. Another election cycle, term limits, whatever, another economic downturn, and it's going to be different players. It's going to be different outcomes for some of these business models. These are mining particularly highly speculative ventures, and not you enter them with optimism, but they don't always happen as you plan. I'd like to leave with you what I call the parable of Fisher's Mill. Before Senate Bill 100, a development of 26 homes occurred on a rural parcel in, between Redland Road and Springwater in Clackamas County, served by a collective septic system and sand filter. And after some years, developers no longer interested, the system's not being maintained, it fails, and it becomes a public health issue. Board of Clackamas County Commissioners, who are now a whole different cast of players, decide they need to step in. And one can't argue. The site's a quarter mile from Clear Creek, which is a tributary to the Clackamas River, and a significant water source, drinking water source.
Can you speed this up a little
sorry.
Bit?
Oh, sorry. So they take it on. They have the service districts do it. The people there can't afford to pay for it. So decades on, the ratepayers of the urban service districts are subsidizing the failing rural development. So everybody probably had good intentions, but the reality is there's no do-over buttons. There's no erase. When the exceptions are repealed, there's still structure and burden to be borne in the community.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. We have Catherine Daniels signed up as the last witness, and I would ask you to hurry with your testimony and not repeat what's been said because we're running out of time.
Yes. All right. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Daniels, a recently retired farm and forest land specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I urge you to oppose the passage of Senate Bill 432, including its amendments. I agree with the voices you've heard today in opposition to the bill, and I'm not going to repeat them. Instead, I would like to offer an additional thought for you. The bill assumes that statewide land use planning requirements are an impediment to the rural economic growth and development of these eight counties, when in fact there is no evidence to support this conclusion. To the contrary, thoughtful, up-to-date, comprehensive plans and zoning can attract the kind of development communities desire, as developers and industry often consult these plans for guidance. For example, when I was working, I sometimes got calls from solar developers who wanted to know if I knew of counties that had pre-vetted and planned and zoned areas for solar development, for example, through an overlay zone. And I had to tell them no. I had to tell them our county comprehensive plans in eastern Oregon are almost exclusively over 30 years old. That's almost unheard of in the planning arena, to have 30-year-old plans. They're all pre-1986. So it's no wonder these counties are not in a good position to plan for future growth and development. These plans don't recognize recent trends such as alternative energy development, changes in agriculture, tourism, and so on. The proposed open-ended exceptions process and the amendments, I believe, is a Band-Aid approach, a piecemeal approach to what really is a broader issue. The problem, as I see it, is not the requirement for planning and zoning under current law, but rather the lack of financial resources to update these plans in a more comprehensive fashion to be meaningful and relevant for the communities they represent. Clearly, the legislature doesn't have sufficient money to update all these comprehensive plans. The legislature originally funded the comprehensive plans back in the 1980s. But being realistic, perhaps you would like to consider funding these eight counties to get their comprehensive plans up to date, to give them a shot at attracting the kinds of growth and development they want. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Okay, that's all I have signed up for both of these bills, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 432 and Senate Bill 644. And now, as I said at the beginning, we will start the process of moving these bills down to the Ways and Means Committee. So we will start by opening a work session on
that's
Senate Bill.
Was there anybody else to testify on 2308?
Yes.
Oh, we have more. I've got some more.
So we will open a work session on Senate Bill 432.
Okay.
Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 432, dated 6/22/17.
The Dash what? 13. Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 13 amendments into Senate Bill 432. Is there any discussion, objection? So ordered. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 432 as amended to the floor without recommendation. With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Don't we have to suspend the rules on this one? Okay. Let's. We need a little suspension because we don't have the paperwork.
Because we don't have all the paperwork.
Well, Madam Chair, I withdraw that motion.
Thank you.
I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking final action without the fiscal or revenue impact statements on Senate Bill 432 as amended.
Senator Farioli has moved for a rule suspension so that we can act on Senate Bill 432. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 432 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommend.
No, without recommendation.
Without recommendation. Thank you. And that the measure be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 432 as amended to the Senate floor without recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Yeah. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 644. Do you remember all that?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 644, dated 6/22/17.
Senator Farioli has moved the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 644. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
We need a rule suspension.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking final action on Senate Bill 644 as amended. Without the fiscal or revenue impact statements.
Senator Farioli has moved a rule suspended so that Senate Bill 644 can be considered without the fiscal and revenue impact statements. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Farioli.
And Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 644 as amended to the floor without recommendation, and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Bill 644 as amended to the Senate without recommendation, and that the measure be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Senator Roblin.
I look forward to seeing this in the next committee.
Some people have all the fun around here. Is there any objection?
Hey, you'll know why it's happening.
We don't. So ordered. Okay, now we will come back to our public hearing on Senate Bill 2308. We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2308. And audience, if we run out of time, I'm going to skip the rest of the public hearing on House Bill 3454, but just say that I don't think the bill has a problem. So if we get to it, we will, but if not, I've sent a message here. Hope you paid attention. Okay, we are now on House Bill 2308. Mickey Logan.
Are you going to do anything with 2750? Just the bridge. Good.
Welcome. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Farioli, members of the committee. I'm Mickey Logan. I'm the Legal Affairs Director at the Oregon State Hospital. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2308, which would give Oregon State Hospital patients who are at the hospital under aid and assist orders. We also call those 370 orders because of the statute. It would give them credit for time in jail. Currently, defendants cannot be committed for longer than 3 years or a period of time equal to the maximum sentence they would receive if they had been convicted, whichever is shorter. These time periods are measured in this current statute from the date of their commitment to the Oregon State Hospital. The Attorney General's Office has advised the State Hospital that patients committed pursuant to the statute, ORS 161370, cannot get credit for time in jail that they spent in jail unless a court explicitly orders that they get credit. In other words, the statute only gives them credit for time at the hospital. This is different from how statutes that treat patients who were found guilty except for insanity. They automatically get credit for time they spent in jail when they're placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. House Bill 2308 would amend ORS 161370 so that aid and assist patients would automatically give time credit for time in jail, and the B7 amendment would prohibit defendants charged with aggravated murder or murder from receiving that credit. In addition, it would also require a court to opt out of giving credit to defendants who are facing Measure 11 crimes. Putting that another way, if a person is charged with a Measure 11 crime under the B7 amendment, the court could order that they not get credit for time in jail. The B8 amendment essentially would carve out all Measure 11 crimes and murder and aggravated murder from the credit for time in jail concept. This whole concept is something that the Oregon State Hospital and Oregon Health Authority have been working with stakeholders on since before this session began. And Oregon Health Authority and State Hospital are fine with either the B7 or the B8. We understand that the ODA is in favor of the B8. Senator Prusansky's testified earlier in favor of Measure 7. The bottom line, it's a good concept. The concept's good, and I just leave you with, we hope that you don't let the perfect get in the way and become the enemy of the good here. We'd like to move this concept forward. I don't have anything else unless you have questions for me.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Thank you. Kevin Neely and Katie Suber, maybe?
There's an explanation.
You don't look like a Katie to me, but...
I think that's an inappropriate statement.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Katie Suber, interestingly, had to go back to the Marion County Courthouse to actually handle one of these cases. So I had hoped to have a day-to-day practitioner. Instead, I have with me Tim Colahan, who is a former retired day-to-day practitioner and is now the executive director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As Ms. Logan said earlier, the Oregon District Attorneys Association opposes the B7 amendments. We support the B8 amendments. I do want to put it in context, however. Oregon State Hospital and Oregon Health Authority came to us probably 9 or 10 months ago with this concept. We had a very cordial conversation about it at the time. On behalf of ODAA, I indicated that we were willing to help in any way we could to try to alleviate the cost burdens that they're facing, as long as it didn't impact the most dangerous offenders. And at the time, they agreed to draft amendments that carved out ballot Measure 11. Then all of this got pulled into a long work group process. This same measure was vetted through that work group process. And again, at least at the time, everyone consented to pulling out ballot Measure 11 offenses. The bill then went to the House. That amendment was put in the bill, and it passed the committee, and it passed the House unanimously. Over here in this chamber, things went a little off the rails. That sometimes happens. And our concern is that the outcome is here that the most dangerous set of offenders now are not going to have the maximum amount of time for the district attorney to make every effort to get them prepared for court so that they can stand trial. These are very... unfortunately, the most high-risk offenders. They've already exhibited a willingness to commit violent crime. And we just want as much time as possible to move forward with the case. I would add they're also a very small part of the population of offenders we're talking about. My guess is that the most cost savings for the state hospital is in the misdemeanors that are there. Again, as Ms. Logan just testified, we can only get up to, for a misdemeanor, 365 days to get them restored. If they spend 2 or 3 weeks in jail before that, that's going to count against them. There's no, we don't get a judicial hearing on that. We've just consented. Let that time count against you, and that would give them essentially $1,000 a day for those 16, 18, 20 days that they were in jail. We just don't think that's the right policy for the most serious offenders. Again, they're a very small percentage of the overall number of offenders that are there. And we would hope that you would consider the A8 amendments, that, or B8, sorry, the B8 amendments that return this bill to the form it was in when it left the House. I'd add one more piece, and that is that B8, what the form it left the House in, is a very significant group of people that go to the state hospital, some of which are indeed fairly dangerous folks. Anyone that has an attempted Measure 11 would qualify under the bill coming out of the House. Anybody that has criminally negligent homicide would have qualified under the bill that's coming out of the House. Again, we're trying to narrow this down to that smallest 20% of offenders that we just need the most possible time and don't want to worry about those folks getting out without us taking the time to get the case resolved. Finally, this really is my last finally, if we don't get them done, literally the hospital, if we don't take any action, opens the door and they walk out. That's the rule. These are really important cases. Again, we're sensitive to the need to save some money here. We're trying to work as collegially as possible with the state hospital and the Oregon Health Authority, but this just goes too far for the DAs. And Tim's here for moral support and legal support.
Well, I think he deserves to talk.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Tim Colahan, not Katie Suver, Executive Director of the District Attorneys Association. Just two quick points. Regarding the credit for time served, I just want to make sure that everybody understands. If these individuals are able to regain the ability to aid and assist, and if they are found guilty, they do in fact get credit for the time they are in jail as well as in hospital. So they do get credit for that time. The other thing I just want to touch on is that under the current bill, 2308B, as well as the B7 amendments, the presumption is that these individuals will get credit. And the problem that we foresee is that there is no standards in the bill as to how a court will make that determination. And we think that in many other areas of the law where a court is given that type of responsibility, they are, in fact, given different types of criteria and standards to apply to make the decision. And the bill as it stands does not have that standard. That's going to be an area of a lot of litigation and uncertainty.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? I think at this late date, time is probably on your side. So, okay.
Well, I don't know. If it went off the rails and now they want an amendment, I tell you.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2308. Do we have anybody left in the room who wants to testify on House Bill 3454? Okay. So come on up. I think we scared most people away, but
lunches.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Welcome.
Right, but I now have a graduate degree
in
land use.
Open the hearing on House Bill 3454.
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Ferrioli, for the record, my name is Matt Newell-Ching. I'm the Public Affairs Director at Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. I want to testify in support of HB 3454 and the accompanying -A2 amendment, which was just posted today. Briefly, I want to thank Representative McClain and Representative Clem for bringing forth this bill. This is the bill to address the issue of shaming in kids receiving school lunches. So remember, when a kid goes through a school lunch, we want to prevent the practice of a child receiving a stamp on their hand to remind them when they go home that they've got unpaid debts. That's a reminder that carries with them their classmates can see. It's also it aims to ban the practice of giving the child what's called an alternative meal. So in many cases, this is literally, bread with like a cold cheese sandwich that gets served. Sometimes it's referred to as the cheese sandwich of shame. I've heard Representative Gomberg refer to it as the scarlet sandwich. Kids have enough to deal with in terms of social pressures. This takes one element away. It was passed unanimously in the House. Just real quick on the Dash A2 amendment, it's a clarifying and technical amendment that just clarifies the original intent of the bill and makes sure that it does exactly what Representative McLean said, which was to limit the practice of serving those alternative meals, as well as banning the practice of the hand stamp. Schools can deal with parents directly, but kids should not have to go through with that in the process. Be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. To your knowledge, is there anyone who supports the bill that for some reason opposes the Dash 2 amendment?
Chair Burdick, we worked with Representative McLean as well as the stakeholders on the bill in drafting the amendment. So as far as we know, all stakeholders approved the amendment language.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you for hanging in there.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the public
hearing. We got two more.
What? Oh, we got two more? Okay. Welcome.
Senator Burdick,
you have to be really quick.
Richard Donovan, on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association, thank you, Representatives Clem and McLean, for their leadership on this issue. This is a relatively uncommon occurrence in Oregon, but it does happen occasionally. It's been a bigger problem nationally. We are in support of the base bill and the Dash A2s. Thank you very much. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. And you're from?
School Boards. Richard Donovan, on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association.
All right.
Hello, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Soren Metzger on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association, representing lunch ladies and gentlemen across the state. And this is for you, Senator Roblin, ditto. We support the bill and the Dash 2 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And sorry to keep you waiting. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3454. And we are on 1 hour notice because we're running into a time crunch. We're going to have to move these bills as quickly as we get the paperwork on the amendments. So we will not be moving.
You don't want to suspend rules, right? No,
we're going to wait. But we will move quickly when we get the paperwork. So with that, we are adjourned. Paperwork. So with that, we are